Pope Leo makes an historic visit to Turkey and Lebanon, calling for ecumenical dialogue and an end to religious violence. How might the Pope influence the region? The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, join me with analysis. And a violent persecution of Christians and religious minorities continues in Nigeria. What is the U.S. State Department doing to curb these atrocities? Director of the Center for Religious Freedom, Nina Shea, is here with an update. While the nation is still reeling after the Afghani national gunned down two National Guardsmen here in Washington, D.C., will there be more terror attacks to come? Middle East foreign policy expert Dr. Waleed Faris is here to tell us. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post, and I'm at Raymond Arroyo. And you can always find me on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. Pope Leo wrapped up his historic visit to Turkey and Lebanon this week. Not surprisingly, ecumenism and relations with Islam were at the forefront of the trip. Meanwhile, Leo continues reforms at the Vatican Curia. Here with insight and analysis is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gents, thanks for being here. I have to start with the release of this years-long Vatican study of the female diaconate. 5 years after it started, the commission has finally released their findings. They ruled that women cannot be admitted to holy orders in this way. And they mention, quote, the masculinity of Christ not being accidental, but an integral part of sacramental identity. Father, as in all these types of documents, there is that little wiggle room they put in there that this is, you know, this needs more study, that somehow it's not definitive. Your take on what this is exactly?
No, this document reflects the fact that they produced a balanced committee to look at the evidence, but that's a function, therefore, of the honesty, I would say, of looking at this question from a historical and theological point of view. Historically, we've never had women deacons, which is an indication that the church didn't think they could do it. And then if you look at the evidence that's given theologically, it comes down to the nature of the incarnation. Christ became incarnate as a man, and then he gave the sacrament of holy orders, the priesthood, the episcopate, and the diaconate to men. The church understood that from the beginning. Therefore, this committee ruled that way. Now, what I like about this document is it confirms what we've always known, because the church has never ordained women as deacons. So that's a good thing. The idea of studying it further, maybe that's just a bureaucratic means of saying people aren't happy about it. Stand by. But I think they'll be standing by for a long time.
Yeah. Bob, wasn't it a definitive ruling of the magisterium, sacred scripture, as well as tradition, long before this commission convened, that you couldn't ordain women to any holy orders?
Well, they mention in the document that there are two passionately held theological positions. And obviously, what Father just said is true, that we just know that it's never been the case that women have been ordained to the diaconate. Now, the theological difference they're claiming is that some people say that the diaconate is not one of those stages toward being ordained a priest. And of course, there are permanent deacons, mostly in the United States and in the West more generally. But just because there's a theological difference doesn't mean there can't be a decision made. And I think that what the decision is good. It reaffirms, as I think every truthful study will show, that we simply can't ordain women as deacons. But at the same time, I think it's a political decision. And that slight door that's left open that you mentioned, Raymond, I think that's just there so that people won't be too outraged. But that, in a way, I think this is inviting further difficulties. Because if you said the door is closed, case closed, then it's settled, and that's
right.
That. If you say, well, but we can study this forever. I mean, everybody who's on the other side of this is going to be agitated forever and say, you know, we hope that some year or someday, you know, I've been joking that maybe in 3025 with another millennium of study, maybe they'll come up with a slightly different view. I mean, it's not going to change. It's one of those things that has been settled for so long and lived for so long in the church that I just don't see how you can do anything other than arrive at the conclusions that this committee thankfully arrived at.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot to unpack from Pope Leo's visit to Lebanon and Turkey. Something that struck me and probably longtime viewers of the show was this warning that the Pope issued about a new Arianism.
A new Arianism present in today's culture and sometimes even among believers. This occurs when Jesus is admired on a merely human level, perhaps even with religious respect, yet not truly regarded as the living and true God among us. His divinity, his lordship over history, is overshadowed, and he is reduced to a great historical figure, a wise teacher, or a prophet who fought for justice, but nothing more. Nicaea reminds us that Jesus Christ is not a figure of the past. He is the Son of God present among us, guiding history toward the future promised by God.
Father, your thoughts on what Leo is getting at here. Why invoke Arianism now?
Well, yes, he invoked it because Arianism was the heresy that was undone by the Council of Nicaea, and that was therefore the wording of the creed is quite clear, light from light, God from God. True. So anyway, but what is also interesting is he said the same thing in his first sermon when he became Pope. He said we should not look at Jesus simply as an admirable figure and reduce him to a humanly understandable, you know, super person, but not the Son of God. No, he is the eternal Son of God. That's what I think he wants to remind us of. And we well need that because it's always a tendency of man, reduce everything to our level so we can master it.
Mm. Leo signed a joint declaration, Bob, with Patriarch Bartholomew, celebrating the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. On its face, this seems wonderful. We're commemorating the council that condemned Arianism with our Orthodox brethren. But is there substance here? Is this more than just symbolic? What did the declaration accomplish, Bob?
Well, look, it's always good to agree with a Christian brother. And I think if there's any progress that is going to be made in ecumenism, it's got to be with the Orthodox because they still have apostolic succession. They have valid sacraments. I mean, during the Cold War, behind the Iron Curtain, Catholics and Orthodox were allowed to worship at each other's churches because it's really that close. Now, the problem in anything more substantive, if that's what you're asking about, Raymond, is that the Orthodox themselves are not all that united, as we know. The Patriarch of Moscow was not there for the celebration of Nicaea. And the various jurisdictions within Orthodoxy, they're competitive. They're often nationalistic. So, look, it's the Universal Patriarch in Constantinople, in what's now Istanbul. You meet with him, you agree to pray together, you remember a time of unity. That's all to the good. The reunification of the church, I think, is only something that God himself can bring about. And we can encourage that where we find opportunities. But ultimately, it's just going to, I think, I'm sorry to say this, but I think realistically, what it does is it promotes friendship. It does not promote unity.
Yeah. There was a moment, and Father, I want your thoughts on this, where, and it kind of didn't make many headlines, Pope Francis gifted Constantinople, the patriarch there, with the relics of St. Peter during one of their visits in the past. Pope Leo wanted those relics back. So they're now being returned to the Vatican from Turkey. Your thoughts on what this means, the reclaiming of those relics of St. Peter, their bones from the tomb of St. Peter beneath the main altar in the Basilica.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that, and I'm not quite sure what the background is, because it was a sign of friendship and the sign of the unity of the Apostolic College, St. Peter, St. Andrew. But Obviously, the bones of St. Peter are under the high altar of St. Peter, and the relics to keep them there is appropriate. And if the patriarch will give them back to Pope Leo, then that's fine. But I'm not quite sure what's going on here.
Yeah. I think it was a sign of accepting, you know, Peter. Oh, Andrew accepting Peter. I think that was part of what this was. And for whatever reason, Pope Leo wants it in his apartment, that reliquary, which I guess was created by Paul VI. So he's taken it back. Let's move to a story from Canada that should really alarm everybody watching tonight. The Liberal government there has struck a deal with the Bloc Québécois to remove religious exemptions from Canada's hate speech laws. Bob, what are we looking at here? I mean, this seems very dangerous, depending on who defines what hate speech is.
Right. I mean, I don't believe in the concept of hate speech, by the way. I believe that there is speech which incites to violence, which ought to be controlled by the law. I don't believe in hate crimes. There are crimes, whatever they're motivated by. If you kill somebody, you kill them. I mean, and the law about murder is applied by the secular authorities. The danger here, of course, is that hate speech very, very often in North America here and in Europe these days applies to biblical principles like the marriage of one man, one woman, mm-hmm. male and female, he created them, that homosexuality is a sin. There are cases, there's a Finnish former politician who's been taken through the courts in Finland because she quoted in a tweet or a, you know, a message somewhere, you know, maybe Facebook, I don't remember the exact place, where she mentions the teaching about homosexuality. So, you know, this sort of thing removes the protection from all different opinions and places this category of hate speech, which is an ideological category, it places it above all other considerations. And we know what happens in modern politics. I mean, maybe you get a more conservative government in them, they don't apply it to Christianity, but in large part, it's applied against Christian groups. Now, it may be, and I'm not so sure about this, it may be that the Canadians are thinking that they also can use this to rein in the more radical elements of Islam, of which there are many in Canada and in the United States. But I have a feeling that this is going to be the fear of Islamophobia is going to keep them away from doing that. And there is no Christophobia that is applicable in politics these days. This is going to have a terrible impact on the Christian churches.
Yeah. Father, very quickly, do you think this will affect homilies? For instance, a priest preaching on human sexuality or marriage in his parish?
Yes. Well, you know, they have these civil rights commissions all over Canada, which are very activist, and they go after free speech and they call it hate speech or incitement, whatever it is. So, yeah, I'm very worried. Yeah, Canada is very comfortable, the government, that is, I don't know about the people, with an interventionist government that's now regulating what you say and think. Very dangerous.
Mm. Okay. The International Society for Civil Liberties and the Rule of Law has issued a scathing statement linking the surge in violence against Nigerian Christians directly to what it calls the Vatican's inconsistent narrative. They're specifically pointing at Cardinal Parolin, the Secretary of State, who characterized this as essentially a dispute between herders and farmers, a social conflict rather than a religious persecution. Bob, how do you explain the Vatican's reluctance to call what many on the ground see, bishops and priests, as targeted religious persecution, if not a genocide?
Yeah, I've mentioned this before, but I think that there's a great reluctance to criticize Islam as such. And there's also a great reluctance, I think, to criticize Africans as such, because it looks like racism or, you know, coming down on poor countries or whatever it is. But look, the Parolin, and by the way, Pope Leo repeated this himself. I think they've been schooled by somebody to say these things. I mean, there is a conflict between these Muslim cowherders and farmers for land, obviously. To mention that is okay, but what they keep doing is they keep diverting from the main point. Yeah. When you have probably 10,000 Christians being killed this very year, in 2025, there probably will be at least 10,000 Christians killed in Nigeria, more than in all the other countries where Christians are persecuted combined. to look at these side issues. You know, it's true they exist, but that means you don't really want to say our people are in particular being whacked by this radical Islam, or even just, you know, everyday Islam that doesn't like Christianity. That happens as well. And therefore, you're making political statements to kind of, you know, smooth things over and not protecting your own people. I'm not surprised that InterSociety, which is a very, very good source, by the way, I quoted in my book on 21st century Catholic persecution. They're a very good, careful organization, Christian inspired, that tries to tell the truth, gets the numbers. And I think that they're quite right to say, look, we can't minimize what is an outrageous large number of Christians dying in this 21st century.
Yeah. Father, it feels like the Vatican two-step on this thing. You know, they come out very strong on the Middle East. They find full-throated condemnation when it comes to something like deporting criminals out of the United States and people who are here illegally. But then when you have a rabid, ongoing genocide of Christians because of their Christianity, the Vatican falls silent and says, oh, it's a hurting conflict.
Yeah, it's disappointing and short-sighted, to say the least, and it's not truthful. And what Bob says is true. Can you imagine any other place where 10,000 people of one religion are killed by people of another religion, and we say this is not a religious conflict? That makes no sense.
Yeah.
Reality imposes itself. That's a principle of life. So I think that's what the local bishops, and by the way, usually the Vatican defers to local hierarchies when it concerns national affairs. They should get back to do that. I mean, let's get a group of Nigerian bishops into Rome and have a meeting, and then, you know, summon all the ambassadors of the world and say, here's why the Christian people in Nigeria are being persecuted. Listen to the people who are experiencing it.
Yeah. Pope Leo has now approved, and I want to talk about some of these reforms that are quietly happening at the Vatican. He approved and published new employment regulations for Vatican employees. Now, we're talking about everything from a minimum 36-hour work week to a 5-year term limit for leadership positions, strict anti-nepotism rules, and even requirements that senior officials submit biennial declarations confirming that they hold no asset in offshore financial centers and no stakes in companies that contradict Catholic social teaching. Now, these regulations take effect January 1st. Father, is this Leo cleaning house?
Yes, it is. It's the Pope and serious people around him. And there were serious people also in the time of Francis when this crisis came to a fore. Is that we've got to stop treating the Vatican bureaucracy involving both clerics and lay people as something that's untouchable. It needs to be reformed. And the reform is in line with modern standards of government management throughout Europe and the free world. So I think it is important. There needs to be accountability. There needs to be, you know, hiring and firing based on verified criteria. And then the money thing, that has to, there's a whole history. We know this from the Vatican leaks thing. There's a whole history of people getting jobs because they know somebody. Yeah. It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah. Bob, there was also, and this just broke today, there's also the story of the Pope eliminating a fundraising organization that Pope Francis had just created in February at the Holy See. I guess the economic secretariat saw some problems there in the accountability, and Pope Leo just evaporated the thing. He vanished it today.
Yeah, I think all these are good signs. I mean, certainly there's nothing in here that anybody who's just familiar with the way that you run large organizations would object to. You have these tried and proven ways of managing things. And these are good signs that he's got getting a grip on some of these neuralgic points about the Vatican that we've been talking about this for years and years.
Yes, we have.
I mean, it's almost laughable when you have movies making fun of money laundering in a place like the Vatican and connections with the mafia and all that sort of thing.
No. Yeah.
But he ran the Augustinians for a while, so he has experience running things. He's run the diocese in Peru in Chiclayo. So maybe some of that past experience, where he probably had more hands-on than Francis did, or maybe Benedict ever did. Benedict certainly was a great, great theologian and a wonderful human being. But as an administrator, he left a certain amount to be desired. So,
yeah.
Look, these are good signs. A lot of these things may look like small matters to people, but these are the kind of things that make people begin to feel that there is an adult in charge. There's responsibility available in the Vatican now.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is all good.
Yeah, more from the Vatican. This is interesting. There have been a recent spate of documents coming out, including those doctrinal notes on marriage, Unicado, the note on Marian titles, about the co-redemptrix, the note on monogamy and polygamy. There was a study on the transmission of faith and a highly anticipated, of course, that final document on the women's leadership in the church. All of these, according to Father Armando Mateo, who's at the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith, fulfill what he calls a mandate given by the late Pope Francis. Father, Francis is gone. Leo is the sovereign pontiff now. Why is the DDF so concerned about carrying on the mandates of the previous pontificate, do you think?
Well, it's obvious that Cardinal Fernandez, who heads the Doctrine of the Faith, is interested in publishing these documents.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they published these two documents on Marian titles and on marriage as being one man, one woman, the Pope Leo agrees to put them out there. But, you know, my question is, we're in the time of synodality. We're expecting the final reports of the 10 commissions. Now, today, we get this thing on the women's diaconate.
Yeah.
Now, the Doctrine of the Faith is going to issue more documents. We're in a time of an explosion of documents from different areas saying different things. I think it's a time to just, you know, pause. You know, let's have a, you know, sort of doctrinal office pause and say for the next 6 months, no documents. Let's simply figure out what is going to be the strategy here. Because right now, this constant issuing of documents, it's forcing everyone to say, well, who's the voice and what's the message?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is, we're on overload right now.
Yeah. Bob, it seems to me, you know, Pope Leo dropped in the middle of the Jubilee year, so he was tied to all these public events, including the one in Nicaea. All of this was kind of predetermined before he ever arrived. And I think somebody convinced him that in the name of continuity, you have to continue, you have to finish the work of Francis. So he's kind of going through the motions and doing that. But around the edges, you see things starting to shift, as we mentioned, in the employment standards, in the abrogation of this office that Francis set up. Do you see here Fernandez, Cardinal Fernandez at the DDF, trying to theologically box Leo in by issuing these documents in this way?
Well, I don't know. You know, there have been reports that some people regard Cardinal Fernandez as accomplished a theologian as Pope Benedict was, Cardinal Ratzinger, when he was the head of the DDF, back then the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. I don't see that. I mean, I look at his documents, I try to read them sympathetically, but it just seems to me that they just don't have the depth that, say, even a Cardinal Mueller would have had when he had headed up that office. So, look, we don't know why Francis is having all these documents come out. We do know that he wants to give the impression, at least, of continuing in the way that Pope Francis did things, and he has given some indications of that. But look, we're looking forward in January. I think January 7th, in other words, at the end of the first week of 2026, there's going to be a consistory of the cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as we've mentioned before, is quite a bit different from the way that Pope Francis operated. He did have a few consistories, but they were, you know, one at the very beginning that was very controversial, and then he didn't want to have many for a while. I think that's going to be a very interesting point. If we find out what happens then,
yeah.
The way he treats the cardinals, does he give them a chance to really tell him some home truths? Does he then act on it? Does he convene them again? Does he have, if real synodality is going to mean the Pope meeting more frequently with his collaborators, his cardinals, that would be a difference from the previous Pope. And I think that if he does that, we're likely to see a better balance and maybe even better decisions being made and activities being carried out in the Vatican, because then we'll be back to a church that isn't just one man making certain proclamations, which are often controversial, but the church acting as one on the key issues.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And Father, I think you'll agree with this. The new year, I think, after the Jubilee is over, with this consistory that was called very suddenly of the world's cardinals to come back to Rome at the top of the new year, Leo, it seems to me Leo will then begin to unveil his actual pontificate, because this has really been cleaning up or finishing up the Francis pontificate much of the last year. But so I want you to reflect on that and this.
Yeah.
There was an administrative action that was underreported, I think, last week at the Vatican, where they possibly ended the use of Latin in administrative operations. Now, in reality, new regulations have been issued to govern Latin's use, and the new rules give flexibility to the drafting of Vatican documents in languages in addition to Latin. The dedicated Latin language office has been reinstated at the Secretariat of State. Latin does remain a liturgical language, and it continues to be the official language of the church. But, Father, this seems like one of these. Again, it's the two-step. You have the option of finalizing your documents in Latin or not, but we're keeping Latin as our official language. What's really going on here?
Well, what's going on here is a recognition of what Pope Francis actually did during his pontificate. You may remember, we used to be surprised because significant documents would first come out in Italian.
Yeah.
And then the Latin version would be published later. Now, that practice is really reflects the fact that no work is done daily in Latin. Nobody's talking Latin or writing Latin memos to each other. That's all gone. Everything is basically done in modern languages. And then an official version would be translated to Latin and then, you know, put into the Acta, which is the official register of Vatican documents. Mm-hmm. I think we're catching up with the fact, and this is a fallout from having a vernacular liturgy. There's no reason for trained seminarians, and hasn't been since the change into the vernacular, to learn Latin. I mean, you could compel people with little sympathy for learning Latin to learn it. In order to be a priest, you need to say Mass in Latin. Now, people that want to say Mass in Latin learn it, but most don't. So I think it's a recognition of reality, and I think it's good for the church that this happened. I'll say that not just because I'm an American. English is the lingua franca of the whole world. The Pope's trip to Lebanon and Turkey, everything was in English. Mm-hmm. Nobody complained that people couldn't understand what he was saying, because that's the language people understand. Administratively, it's right. They didn't just simply come out and say, modern language, Latin or English, Italian, that's going to... No, they just say it's a variation. But the reality is, the longer this pontificate goes, the more business is going to be transacted in English. And I think, saying it just as an objective statement, that's good for the church.
Well, I'm going to object a little bit and throw this to Bob before we go. My take on this, Bob, is that we lose the solidity of Latin, which is not as changeable and fungible as English or other vernaculars. So it was nice to have those documents in Latin because you could cross-check them against the translations, and sometimes we found errors that way. And B, I think by diminishing Latin on the administrative side, you undermine and undercut the ancient Latin liturgy that so many are being drawn to.
Well, I hope that's not the case, Raymond. I think that by and large, this document was overreported as somehow banishing Latin, and I don't see that at all. And I will agree with you this far, that it's important to have these documents in Latin, I believe, because we need to have authoritative texts that we can understand clearly so that we know what we're doing as Catholics. You know, the old joke used to be, at least even people who weren't Catholic would say, at least Catholics know what they believe. And I know from talking with people who have actually worked on putting some of these documents into Latin, one in particular was working on the document about capital punishment, mm-hmm. and told me how they had to look for a word that didn't contradict what had happened earlier, but would say that it was inadmissible, as we're now told. Well, mm-hmm. inadmissible is a pretty vague word, even in Latin. But look, I work in several languages. One of my books is being translated into Italian right now. There are headaches all over the place. The translator has been coming to me and saying it's driving him crazy. You need an authoritative text if you're going to go to something that that is important in the life of Christians in the world. And so there may be translations into Italian or French or English or whatnot, but to have an authoritative text in Latin gives us all a kind of North Star to navigate by. And then we can look at the translations and say, well, wait a minute, that suggests so-and-so in English, or it suggests so-and-so in French. A Latin text is an important thing, and as is a Latin literature.
Well, it breaks my heart to have disagreement among our posse as we leave the segment, but we'll try to bring us back together on the prayerful posse over on Arroyo Grande. We have much more to get to, and we will this week. Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. For commentary from Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, you can also visit thecatholicthing.org. Thank you. She's been tracking the persecution of Christians in Nigeria for years and one of the leading advocates for persecuted Christians around the world. The Trump administration recently redesignated Nigeria a country of particular concern vis-a-vis religious freedom. But what needs to be done now to protect those vulnerable communities? Here to discuss it all, director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, Nina Shea. Nina, always great to see you. You recently testified to Congress about this situation in Nigeria. President Trump approved the CPC designation on October 31st. The next step after designation of this process requires the president to adopt a policy response. Can you give us a sense, first of all, of the scope of what's happening on the ground in Nigeria? And has the violence subsided at all since Trump turned the world's eye to this problem?
Well, there's been a concerted, systematic, egregious, ongoing attack against the Christians, particularly in the Middle Belt or central area of Nigeria. Now, Raymond, the forces attacking them are Fulani jihadists, Fulani militias. These are nomadic Muslim militants who are coming in, not very sophisticated. They come in either walking or on motorcycles with AKs. The Christians have no guns. There's a very strict firearms act that prohibits the Christians and all law-abiding citizens from having guns. But the Fulanis are all armed with AKs, and they mow down the Christians in entire villages. There's also targeted kidnappings. And we heard recently, since this CPC designation, in fact, about 250 school children from St. Mary's Catholic School being kidnapped and taken into the bush. That means into this jungle-like area. And for some reason, nobody knows where they are. This is the entire student body of this school.
Wow.
And nothing's been heard from them since. A nun there said that some are as young as 5 years old.
There's also a priest that was
kidnapped. A priest yesterday was kidnapped from his residence, Father Emmanuel Azima. And his bishop sent out a statement. The archdiocese there in Kaduna sent out a statement. They're very worried, asking for world prayers.
It's just, the scope of this is simply unbelievable. What's amazing to me, as we discussed it a little bit earlier with the posse, the Vatican seems completely unwilling to call this what it is, to say this is Islam driving this, radical Islam. They say, oh, this is really just a land dispute between herders and farmers. You've been covering this for decades, Nina. Is that accurate in any way?
No, that's not accurate. In fact, we had a bishop testify alongside me in before Christmas subcommittee on Representative Christmas subcommittee on Africa. And he said that this is a land grab by the Fulani, who are the biggest persecutors now of Christians in Nigeria, not Boko Haram, not the terrorist groups, but these militias. It's a land grab to Islamicize the area.
Outrageous. You've recommended several actions the U.S. should take immediately to end these Fulani militia attacks on Christians. This week, Secretary of State Marco Rubio posted this. The United States is taking decisive action in response to the atrocities and violence against Christians in Nigeria and around the world. The State Department will restrict U.S. visas for those who knowingly direct, authorize, fund, support, or carry out violations of religious freedom. This visa policy applies to Nigeria and other governments or individuals that persecute people for their religious beliefs. Nina, this was actually one of your recommendations.
That was one of my recommendations. It's a great start. And I think it's very important. A lot of Nigerians want to come to the United States. They want to shop here. They want to invest here. They want to send their children to school here.
What else should the administration be doing?
They should be taking away the guns from the Fulani. There's no reason for these herders to have AKs and assault rifles. And then they should be ramping up the police. Now, the president of Nigeria just announced that he's deploying 100,000 police from protecting VIPs to going to the security areas. So that may be a win for the administration if it's, if you know, as one bishop said, let's see what comes of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if that happens, it could be very, very important if they send it to the right proper areas.
The Nigerian Minister of Defense recently resigned, allegedly for health reasons. What do you think is that about?
Well, the he's been replaced by a Christian general, Christopher Musa, who's well respected. Some call him the Ulysses S. Grant of Nigeria. They think he's going to. He's the answer. So we'll see how that, you know, we'll see what comes of that too. But that happened today. So this is breaking news, and this is happening as a result of President Trump's CPC designation. It was very consequential so far. The power of the White House bully pulpit should not be underestimated.
Now, according to the AP, the departure of U.S. forces from neighboring Niger and their forced eviction from that French base near Chad's capital last year have left fewer resources in the region. Now, we know President Trump floated the idea of sending the military in recently. Do you think this merits that? Or really, this is Nigeria's challenge, and they need to step up.
Nigeria needs to do it. They need to close their borders because they are coming in from Chad and these other Niger, and they need to take responsibility for protecting their own people, including their Christians.
Mm-hmm. Before we run out of time, we've been covering for years now Jimmy Lai's trial in Hong Kong. This hearing that went on for 156 days, an extraordinarily long proceeding. The judges have yet to reach a verdict. We're all kind of in suspense, waiting. He spent 52 days on the witness stand. Here we are in December, no verdict. What is your assessment, first of all, of is a verdict imminent, do you think? And what would you tell us about the nature of this prosecution?
Yeah, well, it's a very political prosecution. They want to suppress all independent thought and any activity outside the party that involves pro-democracy, free speech. And they didn't expect, I think, this backlash from the West. They didn't think the West would care about Jimmy Lai, one person. You know, I met with his daughter, Claire, just a couple weeks ago, and the family doesn't expect a verdict until after the new year, and probably not a sentence till late in the spring. So he's already been in prison in isolation for most of it for 1,800 days. I mean, and his health is deteriorating. He has heart palpitations. He has a number of chronic diseases at this point contracted or developed during his imprisonment.
Wow. Well, we got to pray for Jimmy Lai. I know his children, Sebastian, Claire, were here in Washington meeting with the press. They rallied support for their dad. They met with Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Now, Cruz has been very vocal about the case, having called for Jimmy's release when the proceedings began in 2023. How important was that meeting and Cruz and the Trump administration keeping pressure on China and Hong Kong?
Yes, it's absolutely essential. They do not want their party and their brand tarnished by this coming out. They hope to suppress all news of it. And maybe that's why they're dragging out the verdict, too. Maybe they'll hope he'll pass away in prison and they will never have to say they convicted him. I hope not. I hope he's released. I hope, he's allowed to leave Hong Kong, and he's a British citizen.
Yeah, he should be returned to Britain at the very least.
If they don't want him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and there's also a pastor, Protestant pastor, Jin, who Ezra Jin, who is the father-in-law of my colleague at Hudson Institute, who was imprisoned just in the last month for preaching on the Internet. And, you know, perfectly harmless. He's preaching the gospel. So he has not had a trial either yet. So we'll see what happens. But I think this is a bad sign that they want to eliminate anyone who raises their head or does something outside the party.
Well, you know, this should remind us of that very first Christmas when Herod sent the soldiers out in the fear that this child would somehow rise up. And we see the ongoing shadows of that all through time. But now with Jimmy, with Pastor Jin, and so many others, the brothers and sisters in Nigeria, even here in the United States and Canada, there clearly is an act of persecution. Thank you for continuing to watch it, Nina. We'll have you back. And you can find Nina Shea's reporting on the persecution of Christians worldwide at Hudson.org. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with the legendary singer and actor Frankie Avalon. We had a wide-ranging, really career overview of his journey from a child prodigy, a trumpet player, to a teen idol and movie star, cultural icon, and how he landed that unforgettable role in Grease, which he turned down initially. Tell me about 1978. You're offered a role in Grease. You had seen the play?
Yeah.
You've seen the play?
Yeah.
So you were not keen on taking this teen angel role.
Well, as I say, you know, I was playing golf and I came off and my manager had the script in his hand and he said, Paramount wants you for this film. I said, what is it? He said, Grease. I said, what character? He said, teen angel. And I said, nah, pass. And I went and played backside game. He said, they won't talk to you about the... I said, okay. So I go in, and Randall Clauser, the director, Alan Carr, producer, right. And we sit and talk to, why don't you want to do it? I saw the play. It's Presley. It's long sideburns. It's all in black. They said, we'll change
not
it.
Me. Really?
Yeah. I said, no, I got a style. They said, we'll change it. So they put me all in white. I did Beauty School Dropout, No Graduation Day for You. So I sang it, you know.
Yeah.
Not in Beauty School Dropout.
Yeah.
Not in Dude.
No, you did it in your smooth style, romantic
that
style.
That was it, yeah. And
50 years later, yeah. Almost.
45.
All right.
45.
We're close.
Yeah, close.
People are still singing this song and loving that.
Yeah.
It's become iconic. What's the secret? If you had to say, this is the secret to maintaining a relationship over that time. And as you said, marriages have up and ups.
Well, I think it's respect. Mm. Respect in what they do, what you do to each other and in life, period. Mm. You know, she's an amazing woman. She's just wonderful.
A great lady. Yeah. The full Arroyo Grande interview with Frankie Avalon is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. Wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart, and subscribe. Never miss an episode of the Arroyo Grande Show. It's free. So go to wherever you get your podcast or YouTube, Arroyo Grande Show. And, of course, be on the lookout for Friday's installment of the Prayerful Posse. We're going to talk about the Pope's relationship with Islam, the ordination of women in the church that still is sort of an open question, and much more. Father Gerald Murray, Robert Royal, and myself. Go to Arroyo Grande Show, wherever you get your podcast or on YouTube. Last week's shooting here in D.C. by an Afghani national left one National Guardsman dead and another critically wounded who continues to fight for his life. Meanwhile, ICE illegal immigration raids are ramping up in high-crime cities like Minneapolis and New Orleans. What do these events tell us about the current threat level here in the U.S. homeland? And with analysis of that and more, I'm joined by foreign policy analyst, co-host of the War and Freedom podcast, Dr. Waleed Faris. Waleed, thanks for being here. I have to start with this tragic shooting of these two National Guard members not far from where I sit on the day before Thanksgiving. The shooter's a 29-year-old Afghan national who ambushed these guardsmen. U.S. Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom died of her injuries. Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf, as I mentioned earlier, remains in critical condition. Waleed, what do we really know about this shooter, his history with the CIA, and his apparent radicalization here in the U.S.?
The 3 points you made, Raymond, three things. The first, number one, that he was recruited by Afghan special forces in Afghanistan, trained by our special forces, allegedly retrained or used by our CIA. So he has a chunk of his history in Afghanistan. He fought in our ranks against the Taliban. Then he came to the United States, and that's the real question, the first real question. How did he come? Is it through the program of bringing those fighters here and resettling them? Is there a problem with the vetting? But the third point is the most important. While on U.S. soil, what is his history? Apparently, for him to shoot them, and apparently for him to have made statements in that direction, general direction, made him into a jihadist at the end of the day. So it is possible that you start on the right path. A big event like the withdrawal, the unorganized withdrawal from Afghanistan, and the consequences here. And thirdly, a radicalization that took place on U.S. soil, which is of great concern to me. The factories are not anymore inside the greater Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, elsewhere. The factories are now on the inside, and that's of great concern.
The administration's response has been swift, Waleed. Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced the State Department has paused visa issuances for all individuals traveling on Afghan passports. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services announced it's pausing all asylum decisions until they can ensure that every alien is vetted and screened to the maximum degree possible. Waleed, has this been the proper response, or is this collective punishment, as some critics claim?
Few points, Raymond. Number one, I personally had that conversation, my first conversation actually with the President Donald Trump in New York, in his office, in his tower. His first question was what to do about those jihadists or jihadists to be inside the United States, talking about 2015. And he was very convinced that we need to have a strong policy of what he called maximum pressure, maximum vetting. And he was right. But guess what happened? During the first mandate, as for many other issues, there was an intifada on him from within his own bureaucracy. His own agencies were not really carrying his policies because we have wasted 4 years of a first Trump administration not being able. Our hands were tied up as an administration to go all the way of what he's doing right now. And the difference is now he has a strong cabinet. He has agencies with people who respond to his requests and orders. So we are on square one moving forward. At least we are moving forward.
Here's the real question. What is it in Islam that allows this kind of, I hesitate to call it this, but it's what it is, this kind of double face, if you will. One where you're helping America, we're translating and we're fighting at your side, and then they come to America and suddenly they turn against us. What is it in Islam that facilitates that mindset, if you will?
In general terms, before going into the details, I'm getting there in a second. Mm-hmm. I was surprised when I came in as an immigrant, right? Now, people forgot that I'm an immigrant who came 32 years ago. And I came already as a professor almost, and I taught Middle Eastern studies and Islamic studies and religious conflict. And here I realized that there is something wrong with our understanding of what it was. Because you're asking me, what is it about? And I saw that big problem actually, not just after 9/11, but before 9/11 and the crucial 10 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that was the next thing to deal with. But one of my conclusions is, yes, we can have a theological debate about what is Islam, what is Christianity, what makes this. But I have pinpointed, we have identified, a group of us at least, that there is a very specific ideology. It's not something in the air. It's called jihadism. It has controlled part of the Islamic civilization, as other extremists, you know, like the Nazism, have controlled part of Western civilization. And that is where the problem, in the sense that they, the jihadists in general, their ideologues, we know many, many among them, I've studied them, and some are still alive, they convince their, you know, their partisans, their supporters, so they convince those who start to believe in them that the ultimate goal, the absolute ultimate goal, is the creation of a caliphate, is the control of the world. I mean, that was also the call of the Bolsheviks, the Soviets, etc. So there is part of the story that many Americans are not yet getting because of our media or our academia. It is the concept of taqiyya. Now, many people keep talking about taqiyya, T-A-Q-I-Y-A. It's deception, and it's part of the jihadist ideology. What it means, in layman's term, is that when you have to, you could say any story about why you need the help of the infidels. And in this case, what was the help? In the case of Afghanistan, but in many other countries, take us to America because we are persecuted here. Take us to America because we are persecuted here. We helped you there, so we can help you here. But if you already have been radicalized into a jihadist, you could simply say it, and once you get to where you want to go, revert back to your initial jihadist ideology, and it will be perfectly sitting, you know, not even negated by the jihadists. They're not lying. They think that they're not lying. In fact, that's what they're doing, actually, is deception.
Wow. Yeah. I've heard of that doctrine. And again, that's part of the ideology that has overtaken the radical side of Islam. Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, Waleed, announced 2 weeks ago, just prior to the D.C. shootings, that he designated CARE and the Muslim Brotherhood as foreign terrorist organizations. Governor Abbott stated the Muslim Brotherhood and CARE have long made their goals clear to forcibly impose Sharia law and establish Islam's mastership of the world, just what you're talking about. What is your assessment of this really unprecedented state-level action by Governor Abbott?
Let me start with us in the studio, your brilliant studio. We have discussed this God many times, you and I, and of course other anchors and you with other experts. This is something that we lived, actually, and I personally made it into my central academic experiences in my teaching of Middle Eastern studies. And this has a 31-year-old history on U.S. soil from the 90s, before and after 9/11, so on and so forth. The Muslim Brotherhood basically is the mothership. Just imagine in a science fiction movie, that's the mothership. Out of the mothership, there are other ships, spaceships, Al-Qaeda, Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya, HTS in Syria, since we have been speaking about it. And the mothership basically teaches the ideology. They have chapters, but that is not the most important thing they have. They are producing the ideology, and the ideology is being used by chapters of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then a second generation and a third generation. So what's within America is not just the Muslim Brotherhood, but at least it is identified either by the central agencies who should be doing the same as Texas, but also now, and it's surprising to see that some states, now it's Texas, but it could be Florida soon enough. It could be other states. It could be 15 to 17 states. That would be very helpful. So the work of the administration from the top and designating three chapters, Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon now, and we can talk about it, the speed of which, what we should do about it. But there is a bottom-up movement which is happening for the first time, and the governor of Texas has initiated this because states are closer to their ground, to their grassroots. So yes, in Texas, there is a clearly manifest presence of jihadists camouflaging as institutions. And when I said that, when I wrote that in my book, 20 years ago, I'm glad I'm doing this interview now with you, Future Jihad, 20 years ago, and there have been multiple versions of it, I was attacked by whom? By CARE. CARE said, you know, Faris is Islamophobe because he's awakening the American public in an intellectual way to what we are doing. So have been attacked for years and for years. So starting there is important. What needs to be done at the national level is a campaign of awareness. Awareness for the American public to understand what is that ideology, how can you identify it, and just not panic, just have a plan, a strategic plan to go about it. And in my view, conclusion is education. It's the classroom. It's the schools. That's where we should start.
Yeah. Also in Texas, there are concerns over proposed Islamic communities, Waleed. In Epic City, now rebranded as The Meadow, this is a 402-acre development in unincorporated Collin and Hunt counties in Texas that would include over 1,000 residential units, a mosque, a K-12 faith-based school, community college, commercial developments. Governor Abbott has launched multiple investigations. There's also a massive 150,000-square-foot Islamic center in Houston. Your thoughts on these developments? What's the legitimate concern here versus what could be religious discrimination?
No, absolutely. It's a great question, and I'm glad that you are asking it because that should have been done if not in 91, 92, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but at least after 9/11, I've been in discussions with DHS, FBI, all this stuff. But then came 8 years of the Obama administration, followed 4 years later by the Biden administration, which has frozen and stopped this debate. So it's like you and I are discussing now. We are in 2012. We lost a lot of time in that debate. But in a short discussion, I make a distinction between normal, natural growth of communities. And America is a land of opportunity. You want to have a religious center. Have you want to buy a lot of land? Buy. That's not the problem. The problem is who is in control of it, what they are saying, what they are doing. And the concern is that the Brotherhood and other jihadists are the main command and control centers of this operation. For example, educational centers, fine. But let me see your history books. Let me see your civic books. Let me see your political science books. That's where they are cooking, a process of indoctrination of youth. That's what it is. It happened in the 30s with the National Socialists and in many other places, with the Baathists in Syria. So let's not be shy about it. It doesn't matter if it's now in Texas or it's in Idaho or it's in Bordeaux in France.
Yeah.
That's how the jihadists operate. Education, grassroots.
Waleed, I only have a couple of minutes. I have to get to Pope Leo's historic visit to Turkey and Lebanon, an area you know so well. As a native of Lebanon, what was the spiritual significance of this visit, and what impact, if any, do you think Pope Leo had going there?
Let me quickly say I make a distinction between the importance of this visit, which is always important, and I think I've attended one, but long time ago. I've been away from Lebanon because of the threats inside Lebanon today. The Pope in Turkey, Turkey has among the ancient Christian sites, but the country is not Christian. There's a small minority. Lebanon, the Christians have founded Mount Lebanon first, and then, of course, the Lebanese Republic. And there's a large Christian population which has been submitted to suppression, to threats by Hezbollah, by the Muslim Brotherhood, by others. And a lot of moderate Muslims as well, to have to see the Pope appearing is a big sign, a big shot of morale and spirituality that they need. They need to be connected to the international Catholic, in that case, Orthodox or Christian world, and also to the moderates in the Muslim world. And it happened with this Pope.
Mm-hmm. That's a good, that was a beautiful thing. And you saw them come out. I mean, really, it was the entire community that came to welcome him and celebrate Mass with him. That was beautiful. I think some of the language used to kind of avoid saying anything negative about Islam was problematic. He should have been, I wish he would have been a little more forthright. I mean, yeah, he said religion shouldn't be used for violence, but again, it's so nuanced. A clear declaration, I think, might have been helpful, particularly in that region of the world. That is, and this population, his own people that are being so persecuted right now. I'll give you the last word.
Absolutely. You know what? It's right. Christians in the Middle East, we see what's happening in Syria. They are persecuted. What happened to the Assyrians and Yazidis in Iraq? What's happening now in Nigeria? I mean, there is an assault on this community. Problem is not in the region. The problem is in the intellectual circles and expertise in the Vatican, and you're the expert on that. They should change foreign policy in the Vatican to equip the Pope with the narrative you're talking about, because he's not just the head of, bureaucracies, you know, the Vatican, the biggest one, but he's the head of a spiritual movement, which is Christianity.
Yeah. We will leave it there, Waleed. Iran, an Imperialist Republic and U.S. Policy by Dr. Waleed Faris is available at bookstores everywhere and online. Waleed, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Raymond.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.